This is the Afternoon Magazine. Good afternoon. I'm Celeste Quinn. At the age of 10, Janice Ian fell in love with the guitar. Not long after, she was writing songs and making tapes. Here's a recording she made on her father's reel-to-reel tape recorder. It was her first song, Hair of Spun Gold. She says, it was the best of songs, it was the worst of songs, but as she says, it was her song.
When I was just the age of 5, my world had just come alive. Wondrous things to be seen and be done. All that I could think of was fun. With hair of spun gold, lips of and when I was just the age of 10, my life, it did change again.
Janice Ian's first song, Hair of Spun Gold. A few years later, in 1966, at the age of 15, she had her first hit. She had her first fan mail, and she had her first death threats. That first hit song, Society's Child, was about a young interracial couple.
Come to my door. Clean and shining black as night. My mother went to answer, you know that you look so fine. Now I could understand your tears and your shame. She called you boy instead of your name. When she wouldn't let you inside, when she turned.
Society's Child. Despite the hostile reaction by some, Janice Ian kept on. She's been writing and singing songs now for more than 40 years. Her song At 17 was embraced by fans in the mid-1970s and continues to resonate with each succeeding generation. Janice Ian is a Grammy Award-winning songwriter and singer. She also writes science fiction. Her autobiography, Society's Child, has just been published by Tarcher Penguin. And a companion CD collection, Best of Janice Ian, has been issued by Rude Girl Records. Janice Ian is our guest this afternoon. And if you'd like to join our conversation, listeners, give us a call. Your questions and comments are invited. The number in the Champaign-Urbana area, 333-9455. That's 333-WILL. We also have a toll-free number, that number, 800-222-9455, 800-222-WILL. And you can find our guest, Janice Ian, online at janiceian.com. Janice Ian, thank you so much for joining us this afternoon.
My pleasure.
So good to talk with you.
Thanks.
Well, here we are. It's mid-August, and I thought maybe you would tell us about your camp memories.
My camp memories, wow. I went to a, I suppose, what would now be called a leftist camp called Camp Woodland when I was 8 or 7. My dad, who was a music teacher by then, having been a farmer in my early years, got a summer job teaching at Woodland as music teacher, and because of that, he could trade out his salary so that I could attend camp. And I started, gosh, when I was 7, I went again when I was 10, and then Woodland morphed into Webatuck and Abelard, and I kept going until I was working full-time at 16 or 15. You know, camp for me was a camp in the library were my two lifesavers. Camp because there were other people like me there, and the library because it taught me that there were other people like me somewhere.
Yeah. Camp Webatuck.
Camp Webatuck.
Who were the counselors?
Oh, gosh, I can't even remember.
But they, you had some music counselors.
We had amazing music counselors.
Yeah.
Yeah, and I can tell you as a working musician that the idea of going somewhere for a week or two and getting to stay in the mountains and get fed every day and have your own cabin in return for just kind of singing a few songs is pretty attractive. Oh, we had Richie Havens and Bernice Reagan from the SNCC Freedom Singers. Pete Seeger came up every so often. It was a great group of people.
Yeah. And you first picked up a guitar at Camp Woodland, and you were 10 years old, and you fell in love.
I did. I don't know why I hadn't noticed it before, probably because I'd been so obsessed with the piano, but my dad played just a little bit of guitar, and one of the counselors must have been playing, and I said, wow, let me try that. And it was just a revelation, the way it felt under my fingers and the way it felt pressed against my body. I still remember how hard it was to develop calluses and how frustrating it was to have to play for so many hours a day and feel like I was getting nowhere. I still feel that way now and then.
Yeah. One of the things you say about the guitar in Society's Child, the autobiography, is that, best of all, there didn't seem to be any rules when it came to the guitar.
Well, that was a lot of it. I was, I guess now you would refer to me as a prodigy on the piano. I started when I was 2 and a half. And classical piano is very regimented. It's tough for someone like me who doesn't like regimentation in the first place. I'm one of those people who doesn't play particularly well with others. I do my best when I'm just doing what I do and don't have to explain anything or really deal with anyone. So classical piano was rough for me in that sense. There was no improvisation allowed. You couldn't deviate from what the teacher's interpretation was. And then I got to guitar, where suddenly none of that mattered, and you were allowed to do whatever you wanted, pretty much, still, you know, to this day.
Yeah. Did you see yourself as a rebel as a kid? Do you see yourself that way now?
No.
No.
No, I never even thought of it in those terms. I just, if anything, I saw myself as just trying to stay below the radar so nobody would bother me.
Would it be fair to say that one of the most important things you got from your parents was a sense of fairness, though, and the capability, the necessity to speak your mind?
I think that would be fair. My folks were, like a lot of first-generation Americans, very concerned that I grew up understanding just how lucky I was to be here. And within that, how important it was, particularly since my grandparents had come from Russia, which at the time was the great totalitarian state, that I understand that people had sacrificed so that I would have these opportunities, and in turn it was expected that I would stick up for other people to make sure they would have the same opportunities. It's a very early version of paying it forward, really, and karma. It's the whole concept that, what's the poem, if I am not for myself, then who? If I am not for myself, then who will be for me? If I am not for others, who will be for me?
Mm. Your parents were fans of the music of Big Bill Brunzi and Lead Belly and Odetta, among others. What kind of household was it? What was the music?
A noisy one.
Yeah.
Busy household. You know, my parents loved music. My dad wanted to be a music teacher, and when he finished his army stint, he got to go to college on the GI Bill and became one. My mother loved to sing. My grandparents all sang. Again, I think like most immigrant families, and particularly Jewish immigrant families, music was one of the ties that bound us together. I have vivid memories of the Seders, the Passover meals every year, when all my grandparents would sing the songs of Passover the way that they had learned them as children. And my grandfather came from a tiny little village called Tashkent, which was right on the Mongolian border, and his renditions had a very distinctive Chinese sound to them, or Asian sound, I guess you would say now, whereas my grandmother's coming from Kiev sounded very Russian. My other grandmother's coming from Poland sounded very different. Just a lot of music and a lot of... We listened really to everything but pop music, which my parents were kind of embarrassed by and thought wasn't really music, so... It was hard for them when I went into it.
This is the Afternoon Magazine. Our guest this afternoon is Janice Ian. Her autobiography, Society's Child, is just out from Tarcher Penguin.
A real publisher. My aunt was so pleased that I had a real publisher.
Well, I kind of like the idea of Rude Girl Productions myself.
There's a story behind that, yeah.
Yeah, well, maybe we'll get to that. This is the Afternoon Magazine. My name is Celeste Quinn. Listeners, you can join us this afternoon. 333-9455, the number in the Champaign-Urbana area. Anywhere else, toll-free, 800-222-9455. Let's take a call now. A listener in Indiana on line 4. Hi.
Hello.
Hi there.
I'm glad I tuned in today to thank her. The song at 17 was important for me to sort of break through the 50s pressure on young men to, let's say, date only beautiful women, quote unquote.
Oh, I never thought of that.
I found myself being attracted to all kinds of different kinds of styles of women.
Well, good for you.
And my buddies would question me. My father went so far to question why I was marrying the woman I married.
Because really?
Because she was so plain-looking.
You're kidding.
And I know. And I had lived near a resort, and there's a certain facility I have, and I used to go to his house with girls, mainly to drive his sports cars, and he always thought they were luscious women and why I didn't marry one. And I looked him in the face and said, because I didn't fall in love with one.
Well, good for you.
And I wish I'd had your song at that time to, you know, throw at him.
He's a
jazz freak, and he would have understood, perhaps.
Oh, that's really interesting. I never thought about any of that. Thanks for sharing that.
Thanks for the call. Any comments you want to follow up on? Maybe we talk a little bit here about At 17.
You know, the most interesting thing about that song to me still, and certainly when it was first being a hit, was that I was really clueless that anyone else felt that way, and much less that men had the same issues. I mean, that just blew me away. And I remember being backstage one day, and quite literally the captain of the football team and the captain of the cheerleading team were brought backstage, and they both thanked me for the song. And I looked at them, and she was very, very pretty, and he was very, very handsome. And I remember saying to him, I really don't get the connection for you. I mean, surely you have a date every Friday night. And he kind of laughed and said, yeah, and you should see how they look at me when I don't. And I thought, wow, I never thought that if you were good-looking, there were the same pressures, you know, maybe slightly different, but the same amount of pressure on you at that age. That just totally blew me away.
Yeah. I remember playing that over and over and
really?
Over again. Yeah.
Oh.
Until the record would hardly play anymore.
Yeah,
it was
that,
on
that
vinyl.
Is the one good thing about CDs these days. You know, I always encourage people to make copies of their CDs because there's really no research on how they'll last.
This is the Afternoon Magazine. Our guest this afternoon, Janice Ian. We're going to get At 17 queued up and maybe play a bit of that.
Sure.
Maybe you would talk with us about how it was that you came to write it.
It's one of the few songs where I can really draw a trail from one thing to the next. I was sitting at my mother's kitchen table, I believe. I had to move in back with her because I was broke, and I was trying to make a record and get off on tour and make a little bit of money. And she had brought the New York Times home, and I was looking through the magazine section. I had a guitar in my hands, and I was playing a little samba figure that went ding 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 da 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 dum. And I stumbled across an article by a woman who said that she had thought that becoming a debutante and having a coming out ball would solve all of her problems. And I remember the article opened, I think, with the line, "I learned the truth at 18." And I thought, wow, that's a cool line, but it didn't quite scan. You know, I learned the truth at 18. didn't work. So I wound up going, I learned the truth at 17, and that scanned. And one of those fortuitous moments in a life where you look back and go, I'm so grateful for the talent I was born with because I actually got to do something with it.
Let's hear a bit of At 17.
I learned the truth at 17, that love was meant for beauty queens and high school girls with clear-skinned smiles who married young and then retired. The Valentines I never knew, the Friday night charades of youth were spent on one more beautiful. At 17 I learned the truth. And those of us with ravaged faces, lacking in the social graces, desperately remained at home, inventing lovers on the phone, who called to say, come dance with me, and murmured vague obscenities. It isn't all it seems. It's 17. A brown-eyed girl in hand-me-downs, whose name I never could said, pity please the ones who serve, they only get what they deserve. In the rich relationed hometown queen marries into what she needs with a guarantee of company and haven for the elderly. Remember,
Janice Ian at 17. It's so clear in your music that music to you brings so much comfort and joy.
Yeah, it really does. Music and just writing in general, Celeste. My partner turned around to me once and she said, okay, I get it now. If the world was falling apart around your ears and the house was coming apart at the seams and there was a tornado outside, if you were in the middle of a song that was going well, you wouldn't notice. And I said, now you understand, yes. There's a lot of truth to that.
Yeah.
I think that it's in the nature of a writer to be obsessive, maybe in a good way, maybe sometimes not in such a good way, but in general in a good way. And certainly you have to be focused enough that you can exclude everything else going on while you're doing your work. Sometimes I know it's frustrating for people who live with writers, and I don't blame them because I could see where it would get really, 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 really annoying after a while.
Yeah, but your partner seems to understand. She gave you a set of pens.
She did. When you're in public a lot, when you're a public figure, much as that sounds like a politician and not a songwriter, but when you spend a lot of your time in the public eye and performing and being told how fabulous you are with people who genuinely think you're fabulous or think your work is fabulous at least, I think that it's very easy for people to forget that you're normal. And people tend to buy you presents that are expensive rather than what you want. And Pat, my partner, understood one year that what I really wanted was a bunch of not very expensive pens and paper pads, and that would make me happy. And trust me, every time I open the pen drawer, every time I look inside the closet and see those pads, I smile.
Yeah.
It's like no matter what goes wrong, I'll still be able to write on my preferred pads with my preferred pens.
If the world is coming down around you.
That's right, so long as I have my pen and my pads.
Yeah. I'm thinking of, you know, Woody Guthrie, you know, in the dust storm writing "So Long It's Been Good to Know Ya."
There you go. Yeah. There you go. Oh, my gosh, what a writer. Yeah, I had the amazing privilege of finishing a song of his that started out as a song called "Mother Sing Again" and morphed into a song called "I Hear You Sing Again" that his daughter Nora sent me the lyrics to. And that was another of those rare experiences where I literally looked at the lyric and heard a melody in my head and sat down and wrote it in about 2 hours. Yeah, Woody Guthrie, gosh, big shoes to fill. Mm. Oof. Mm.
Let's take another call. A listener in Champaign. Line one, hi.
Hi, Janice Ian. Wow, first off, let me say your music has been so important to me for 20 years at
least. Oh, thank you.
And I guess I'd like to ask you about one song, if I could.
Sure. I may not be able to answer. Fair warning here.
Well, I just graduated from design school, and one of your songs that was really helpful to me when I was working on my thesis was "From Me to You."
Oh, how cool!
I played kind of obsessively, and I was wondering if you could talk to me a little bit about where that came from.
You know, I really hate commenting on songs that way because, to me, the minute that I start saying this is what it means to me, it takes it away from whoever's listening.
Sure. It's just so rich. There's so much going on in it, so many sort of different emotions, and at the same time, I don't know, really powerful. Seems to hit on all cylinders for me.
Well, it's a funny thing about that song. I love that song, and I've been trying to take it out of my show for years and replace it with something else just to make a change.
Sure.
And every time I try to do that, I get so many complaints that it goes right back into the show.
Yeah.
Yeah, it seems to be a very strong song and to evoke pretty strong feelings in people.
It really does for me. I'm wondering if, is the guitar tab available? Are tabs available to your music at all?
You know what? You'd have to check on my website.
Okay.
If you go to janiceian.com,
I've been there.
Yeah, we've managed to actually kind of be in the forefront of the concept of digital songbooks. And I think they're $6.95 or $7.95 for the songbook. It should be in one of them.
Oh, great. That's so wonderful. Well, it was wonderful to get a chance just to talk with you briefly.
Oh, thanks. Thanks. Well, thanks for the kind words about that song. I will say that it's one of my own favorites. So there you go.
Glad
you know,
to
for
hear
what
that.
That's worth.
Thank you very much.
My pleasure.
Bye.
Should we hear a little bit of that song?
Sure. I love that song.
Okay. This is "From Me to You," and this is from a live recording that you did at the Bottom Line.
Oh, okay.
Okay.
Oh, yeah.
Here we go.
I'm leaving by night. I'm leaving alone. Leaving your life. When you wake and I'll be gone. I would not beg for me as I could not beg for you. Though I'd like to be the one to see you through. Every step you have taken disappears with the tide. You're torn up and shaken with changing your mind. You haven't got the grace to see you finally decide. And you haven't got the strength to stay to fight. Those people who surround you only want to see you weak enough to crawl. They'll lie for you, they decide for you, and they buy up all your rights and all your wrongs. And they'll try and stop your singing in the middle of your song. For they do not want you free, and they will not make you strong. They'll only drag you down in the hole they're coming from. They see you are foolish in wanting the sun. See you are shellfish in learning to run. They'll tell you that the darkness is a blessing in disguise. For you never have to notice if you're sighted or you're blind. And they'll do their best to keep you from the light.
"From Me to You." This is from a live recording made at the Bottom Line.
Wow. I haven't heard that in years. Wow.
Yeah. When did you write that?
Oh, gosh. I think 72 or 73 maybe.
Okay.
72, right in there.
Yeah. Yeah. Very good.
It's just funny, you know, and I can't listen, obviously, to my own work the way other people can listen to my work, which is probably just as well. I'm always one step removed, so when I'm listening to something like that, I'm busy thinking, wow, who was playing the fiddle on that? I don't remember having a fiddle player. You know, asking myself those kind of questions.
Yeah, yeah. Maybe we would talk a little bit now about Society's Child. Very early in the book, Society's Child, your autobiography, readers find you on stage in Encino, California, and you're 15 years old, and people came to see you who loved Society's Child, but there were also people in that audience just filled with hate.
Yeah, that was pretty amazing. There was an entire claque of people who came and bought tickets, literally, so they could try and boo me off the stage by screaming nigger lover at me. And they succeeded at first. I didn't know what to do. I'd only been on a concert stage maybe 4 or 5 times in my life till then. I was 15. And I did leave the stage because I started to cry, and I didn't want them to see me crying. But I was talked into going back out by the promoter, who in retrospect was probably just worried about having to give refunds to all of those people, but who said to me at the time that if I let them win, then they would be encouraged to do this to the next person and the person after that. And he said something like, and pretty soon the only people who will be allowed on stage in this country are people who agree with them, and you can't be party to that. That made a lot of sense. You know, and it's a, boy, it's hard to explain to people now how divided the country was and how scared people were, how scared the powers that be were, and how angry they were at my generation, which they saw as just this one big mass. It's hard to explain to people now the kind of firestorm that Society's Child lit, or the kind of lightning rod that I wound up being because of it. You know, nowadays, who goes to a concert to try and boo someone off the stage? I mean, who sends death threats? Boy, I had just gotten so used to people spitting at me. I was kind of shocked when they didn't.
Yeah. Well, also, you know, this was a time, these were years where African Americans were just beginning to appear on television.
That first Doublemint commercial with two black women, that was just amazing.
And the Cold War was pretty hot.
Right, and there was communist under every bed, old days. Yeah, it's funny to me because when people talk about the good old days and they talk about the 60s, I'm always the one who says, excuse me, I was there, and... You know, people try to say, oh, the music was so much better, and I go, the Cow's Hills, Grand Funk Railroad, yeah, I remember all of that, too. We forget, you know, in our nostalgia, we forget how, we forget what the times were really like.
Yeah. At some point you learned, I don't know how old you were when you learned this, that the CIA had been out to undermine the youth and civil rights movement.
Yeah, I didn't learn that until I started researching the book. I really literally spent last January through March researching. I call it Googling myself. I would wake up in the morning and Google Janice Ian, but also just researching the era because I wanted to make sure that I kept journals since I was 9 or 10, but I wanted to make sure that my perceptions of then hadn't been just totally skewed by the life I was living, that they actually had something to do with the times. And when I ran across that information on, I think it was Project Chaos, where the CIA, who have no business being involved in national affairs anyway, had this real program to disrupt and create lies about the civil rights movement, the Vietnam movement, I was pretty amazed to see that it had been so codified and so organized. I mean, quite honestly, I was surprised that they were that organized. And apparently, there was a lot going on that we as Americans, well, as we found out during Watergate, just were clueless about. And in retrospect, very naive. I think that my generation in general was very naive about how entrenched the powers that be were and what lengths they were willing to go to stay entrenched.
Mm.
In retrospect, all quite frightening.
Mm. At the same time, though, you were aware when you were a kid that your dad had been, you know, under suspicion.
Well, my dad, you know, It's so stupid now.
It is. It sounds so silly.
It does sound silly, and I remember talking about this with a journalist who was in college a few years ago, and she said, "You're joking, right? That never really happened, did it?" And I realized that for her whole generation, this was just unfathomable. But this is the age of the Internet when it's hard to keep a secret. And in those days, J. Edgar Hoover had such a presence. My father had gone to literally a meeting of farmers in South New Jersey about the price of eggs. They were trying to make sure that they didn't undercut each other, that everybody could earn a living. And apparently that made them very suspicious characters. My dad was picked up by an FBI surveillance team on his way home, who questioned him about communist ties. And my dad, who was not a communist by a long shot, talked to them. And then the next time they came, I guess I had just been born, and my dad said, "Look, you can't come in unless you have a search warrant." And they said, "You know what? We're going to put you under surveillance." We didn't find this out for decades until I started trying to get my folks' FBI reports. And at that point, boy, it took 13 years and the intervention of a friend with a friend in the State Department to get the reports. And we discovered that the reason, once my father became a teacher, that he had always been denied tenure was because the FBI would quite literally send agents to the school to talk to his principal and say things like, "Has he been seen consorting with known communists?" And of course, at that point, it went out of the question. It's really difficult to fathom now, and I can understand how people have a problem with it. For us, just my brother and me and my mom, we didn't understand why my dad couldn't get tenure because everybody loved his teaching. My dad couldn't understand why he couldn't get tenure. None of us would ever have dreamed that somebody in an FBI field office had taken a dislike to him and was making life impossible. We would never have dreamed that. All we knew was that we could never afford a house, and I couldn't get a guitar, and we could never stay anywhere longer than a couple of years. Mm. I don't mean to sound like I'm whining about it. I really don't. I'm just looking back now, I'm just appalled that my father had to spend his life as a teacher, which is, to my way of thinking, a very noble profession, at the mercy of people being directed by J. Edgar Hoover, who, my gosh, nowadays we'd have the boy in therapy. He started keeping files on his classmates when he was 7 years old. There's something really wrong with that.
Yeah. Well, at one point along the way, too, your father was threatened that your grandfather would be deported.
Yeah, they...
That's pretty heavy-handed stuff.
It's pretty heavy-handed. It was. My father ran a camp that was advertising itself in the New York Times as multiracial and multicultural, and there were a lot of people who didn't like that. And the FBI wanted to know about a couple of, I guess, our campers, our CITs, counselors in training, who were very active in voter registration drives in the South. And my father refused to turn over the information, which was his right. And they basically said, "Well, you know, your grandparents, my grandparents, your parents are here on sufferance, and we could easily say that they lied on their immigration forms about something, and you wouldn't want to risk that." The stupidity is that just made my dad angry. Mm-hmm. There was no way then he was going to tell them anything.
Stubborn streak.
Yeah, very much
so. In the Fink family.
You know what? Apple doesn't fall far from the tree.
Yeah.
Janice
Ian is our guest this afternoon here on The Afternoon Magazine. Her autobiography, Society's Child, is just out now from Tarcher Penguin. My name is Celeste Quinn. Listeners, you can join us this afternoon with questions, comments, 333-9455, the number in the Champaign-Urbana area, anywhere else, toll-free, 800-222-9455. So how was it, given all this stuff, the tenor of the times, that Society's Child was made into a record and became a hit?
Well, the made into a record part was a series of flukes. I was playing the Gaslight Cafe with the Reverend Gary Davis. I was 14. I had been taking guitar lessons from him, and his wife really liked me, and she just basically insisted that I be allowed to open for him as his opening act. And over the club owner's objections, I was allowed to open. A guy came running backstage and literally said, "Kid, I'm going to make you a star," and I laughed at him. It was such a stupid cliche. But sure enough, the next day I found myself in the office of one of the biggest entertainment industry lawyers in New York, and he took me up to Shadow Morton, a producer, and Shadow listened to what I had written, to make a long story short, all 12 songs, and he picked that one. People keep saying how smart I was to pick it. I had nothing to do with it. That was Shadow's choice. And we went into the studio to record it a week or two later. Atlantic Records paid for it, but then they wouldn't release it because it was about a black boy and a white girl. And Shadow took it around to all 22 record companies in New York then, and they all refused. And then Verve Forecast, which had just been formed by MGM, took it up and released it once, and it got fantastic reviews, but no one would play it because of the subject matter. Well, not no one. I mean, they played it. They played it in actually parts of Illinois. They played it in Chicago. They played it in Flint, Michigan, for some unfathomable reason. But most of the major stations refused to go on it, and exactly the same thing happened when they re-released it. And then the following year, Leonard Bernstein, bless his heart, heard the song and heard the trouble we were having and featured it for almost 15 minutes on a primetime television special he was doing. And all of a sudden, everybody was apologizing and everybody was playing it. It was extraordinary, the power of television, especially, I mean, we only had 7 channels, so it was huge.
We didn't even have that in where I lived.
No, I bet. This was in New York. We had 7 channels.
Yeah.
You're right.
We had 2.
Well, there you go. Just like, well, you were like the British, though.
Let's take another call. A listener in Champaign County, line 1. Hi.
Hi. I really loved your stuff in the 70s. I'm glad you're still doing it. I hope you don't have any wahoos from Kansas demonstrating against you these days.
No, actually, I'm actually playing in Shawnee in late October, and actually it's a tiny club, but I'm looking forward to it because it sounds like a fun gig, and both shows sold out in about 15 minutes, so I'm looking forward to time there. I've always had a good time in Kansas.
I suppose if you're out on NPR, it doesn't mean they've heard about you yet. So
no, that's true.
Okay, this is kind of just a throwaway question. Your stuff really was great for me, and I guess I should listen to some of your contemporary stuff. I haven't been listening.
That's okay.
Too much news, I guess.
Don't worry about it.
But did you have any comparable problem with when you went to more electric and programmic, leaving the folk scene, or was that already
like
broken?
Like Dylan did?
Like Dylan did, yeah.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. A lot of
people. I'll listen to that, and thanks for all your artwork. Thanks.
Well, thank you.
Thanks for the call this afternoon.
Yeah, I think the folk movement. And bless it for sustaining, and thank God it's still there because it helps people like me to earn a living. But there was a period there where it got pretty codified. And if you, I remember one man telling me that a song wasn't a folk song unless it had been written so long ago that we forgot who wrote it. And when I put out Society's Child and it became a hit, a lot of people had real problems with it. They got very angry with me. So I had the folkies on the left yelling at me because I put drums on the record, and I had the righteous right yelling at me because it was about a black boy and a white girl, and I just tried to slip into that crack between and stay there.
Yeah. What did you make of that? You know, you're getting it from all sides.
Yeah, and I felt at the time that it was pretty unfair because I really felt like, I'm not whining, but I really felt like I was on the front lines in a lot of ways, that I was out there getting the death threats, and I was out there getting the picketers, and here were these people more worried that I had put drums on the record than the effect the record was having on the country. So that part was pretty disheartening.
Yeah. I wanted to have you talk about 3 women who championed your work, Janis Joplin, Joan Baez, Ella Fitzgerald.
Mm. Boy, that sounds like a pretty good group, doesn't it?
Big trio there.
Yeah, yeah. Well, Joplin was a friend. She was what I would call a shopping buddy. We would go shopping together for things like the Grammy Awards that we were both on. I think I got my first nomination in 67, and we went shopping for clothes. She was very, very careful of me. She kicked me out of parties when there were drugs, and she thought that I should get gone. She was very different to me than she might have been, say, to somebody her own age. I think I was almost more like a mascot. And she was very, very good to me. One of my big regrets is that I never wrote anything that would have been good for her to record, because I sure would have loved to have her record something of mine.
Mm-hmm.
Ella Fitzgerald is Ella Fitzgerald. And I was sitting watching television one day after a show, and a show came on with Ella, and the host, I think it might have been Mike Douglas, asked her if she listened to any young musicians, and she said, well, yes, she thought she thought Janis Ian was the best young singer in America today, and I fell off the bed. I was just, you know, it wasn't just that that it was Ella Fitzgerald. It was that she knew I existed. I mean, that was amazing, that Ella Fitzgerald actually knew that I existed, that I wrote songs, that that I was a singer, blew me away. You never think about it when you're out there working on a record. You never, or at least I never thought about who might be listening among my heroes, really. Mm-hmm. And so that was just that moment still sticks out in my head as just a shining moment of the joy that you get from a profession like this.
And a bear hug from Joan Baez.
Ah, well, Joan's always been really wonderful to me. And she doesn't even remember this. I talked with her last year or the year before about it. But when I got to the Newport Folk Festival, which was the be-all and end-all of festivals, and which had not invited me for 2 years running on the grounds that I was too young, when I finally got there, I thought that everybody would have forgotten that Society's Child had drums on it. And instead, I found myself in the embarrassing position of going down for breakfast and nobody would look at me. So I kind of turned around and thought, okay, fine. If this is still going on, I'll deal with it. I'm going to go back to my room and eat. And just then, as I turned to leave, Joan came up. I'd never met her, didn't know her at all. But she gave me a huge hug in front of everybody else and kind of gave me her blessing, had me sit at her table with her and her mom, and treated me like a peer. And I think I say in the book, from that moment on, nobody dared to mess with me.
Mm.
It's funny, the things you remember, you know, for outsiders, you would think that the Grammy Awards or getting a Grammy would be the highlights or getting a platinum record would be the highlights. But for me, the highlights would be Ella Fitzgerald saying that or Baez giving me a hug. Stuff like that is so important in your life and means so much more as you look back on the years than an award. I mean, it's not that I'm not grateful for the award, but it's the humans that matter, really.
Yeah, yeah. Well, mentors and teachers, they're the best.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah. We're running down on time. Really quickly, maybe you would tell us about how you began writing science fiction and who's a favorite writer in that genre?
Oh, scary. I grew up on science fiction. My dad loved it. When I was 16 or 13, for my birthday, he gave me his entire collection of Astounding Science Fiction magazine and Galaxy and all the old magazines. So I come by it honestly. And at the end of making one of my albums, I had written to a bunch of writers thanking them for their influence on the album. Anne McCaffrey, Orson Scott Card, Mike Resnick, mostly science fiction writers. And to my delight, a lot of them wrote back, and I became friendly with some of them. Anne McCaffrey was in Ireland, so on my next tour there, I actually took a day and spent the day with her. And Mike Resnick decided for some unfathomable reason that I should write fiction. He read my articles for Performing Songwriter and got it into his head that I needed to do this. And next thing I knew, after I'd said, no, I don't do this, he had turned around and signed a contract committing me to producing a piece for an anthology. And he sent me the contract and said, okay, now you're writing.
Mm.
So I called, I wrote a story. I had no idea I could do that. I'm still not real sure about it. One of the things story writing has taught me is that a lot of what I took to be my talent in music is actually the result of 40-odd years of experience, and I don't have any experience as a short story writer or a novelist. That was one of the hard things about writing the autobiography, just not knowing where to go and running up the occasional blind alley and having to dig my way out of it, whereas with the song, that just wouldn't happen anymore.
Mm.
On the other hand, because it wouldn't happen anymore with a song, it makes prose writing really interesting to me because it's different. It is so different. It's apples and oranges, but it's still writing, and it's still that same thrill you get when you finish a song.
Yeah. We have to wrap up here. I will tell our listeners that later in the program, we have to break for some market information, but later in the program this afternoon, I'll play something from Folk is the New Black, which is one of Janis Ian's most recent recordings. Is that your artwork there, a guitar doing push-up?
No, that's my partner, Pat.
Oh.
She's an attorney by trade.
I looked for credits on here, and I just looked right past it.
Yeah, it should be on there somewhere.
Okay.
But she really is an attorney. That's what she does, but when she was younger, she had been quite an artist, and I couldn't find anybody to do the kind of drawings I wanted. And finally, about 2 weeks before we went to print, I just looked at her and said, "I'm really sorry, but I know you do this, so you're stuck." And she's never forgiven me for it.
Well, she's very talented as well, and she's got a sense of humor. I can
see
that.
She does.
Yeah.
She does.
There we have to leave it, Janis Ian. Thank you very much for talking with
us this
afternoon.
Thank you so much. This was fun.
You're very welcome. Janis Ian, Grammy Award-winning songwriter and singer. She also writes science fiction. We'll look for more fiction from her in the future. Her autobiography, Society's Child, just out from Tartar Penguin, and a companion CD collection, Best of Janis Ian, the Autobiography Collection, has been issued by Root Girl Records.